Weakness and he is going to be the professor.
Hi there. I am not your usual introducer, and actually, Sarah's going to do the introduction, but a short promo for the next 2 weeks, which will finish off the year for us. Trust, it is essential for our lives in faith. And we're going to spend 2 weeks talking about trust and what builds it, what erodes it. And the first week will be by my good friend and scholar, Robin Pashby. You might recall that at the end of the pandemic, she did a series on ambiguous loss, which we were experiencing at that time. She's outstanding, and I know from knowing her how thoroughly well prepared she will be for this discussion. So I encourage you to come back for that. And then after she does it for a week, I will put a cap on it. We're talking about trust in our faith journey and our community of faith. So, with that little promo, I'll turn it over to Sarah.
Thank you, Ted. This is our last session on The Great Divorce by C.S. Lewis with Dr. Suzanne Free. This has been a wonderful series, absolutely. And I encourage you, particularly this last session, to feel free to ask questions, to make comments. If you're online, you can unmute, because I think this topic is complex, and there are no real answers, but I bet you have some questions in the back of your mind. So feel free to do that. And thank you, Sue, for this gift.
You're very welcome. Can you hear me? Or it's working. Very good. Let us begin with prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, and in hell, if we make our bed there, be behind us and before us as we travel to the end of the great divorce and see where Lewis leaves us. Thank you for glimpses of your truth in his fantasy. May we seek to be less and less transparent in this world. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Good morning. Thank you all for coming. We're starting with chapter 7, and I've given the chapter's titles. I would call this one The Conspiracy Theorist. Chapter 7 is short, a low point, and it begins with anxiety. Lou suddenly feels very uneasy in the presence of that huge waterfall that we talked about. Fatigue sets in. He resumes his walk along the riverbank until he comes to a ghost leaning against a tree, smoking a cigar. Lewis calls him the hard-bitten man. He's lean, educated, well-traveled, and glad to talk. He's also cynical, jaded, and a conspiracy theorist. He believes that 1% of the world's population controls and subjugates the other 99% and always will. He calls it the combine. But this pales in comparison to the greatest conspiracy of all, God and Satan, who control everything in the universe and only pretend to be at odds. It's rigged against us from the beginning. Not just indifferent, against us. For him, it started with his parents, who conspired against each other. He says that the excursion bus from hell to heaven is a publicity stunt. It's meant to fail. I remember one of my philosophy professors starting the first class with this line: "Life is a joke. And when you die, God says, get it?" Not that funny. Name any beautiful place on earth: the Alps, the Great Pyramids, Victoria Falls, Everest, Taj Mahal. The hard-bitten man has seen it, done it, and is unimpressed. Even hell is a flop, he says. Not nearly the dramatic combustion he was hoping for. And heaven turns out to be exactly what he did expect, a supersized tourist trap. It lures you in with promises of ideal beauty and peace and sublime pleasures. The reality, you can't walk on the grass, you can't eat the food, you would probably be knocked senseless by the first rainstorm. Raindrops keep falling on my head like bullets. The universe is absurd, he says. It conspires against you from cradle to casket. We are as flies to the gods. They kill us for their sport, says Gloucester in King Lear, and he has his reasons. God and the devil are playing war, the hard-bitten man says. Both sides in all the world wars were run and supplied by the same armament firms. We might add today, the drug companies don't really want a cure for cancer. Treating it is a billion-dollar industry. So all the researchers pretend that they are working hard, but they never seem to arrive at a cure. Hell and heaven are run by the same management, this man tells Lou, so wise up. As we limp around up here trying to have a good time, God and Satan are laughing at us. If the angels really cared about us poor devils in hell, they'd come down and clean out the gray town in a day. As an aside, he also says that it's up to the management, not us, to manage this mess. It's not our job to clean it up. The least they can do is entertain us for the split second of eternity that we're here. He's bored. He's the kind of man who goes out and looks at the stars at night and says, "Is this all there is?" But he's educated. He knows what he's looking at. Massive galaxies colliding, black holes collapsing, violence beyond our imagination, and all of it indifferent to our longings and sufferings. Lou is unnerved by the hard-bitten man. So am I. In certain moods, his arguments sound plausible. After talking to him, a great depression comes over Lou, and the two men part ways. Chapter 8, Homesick for Hell. In Chapter 8, Lou hits rock bottom. He doubts the motives of the bright spirits. He doubts that heaven is a safe place. He doubts the goodness of God. He thinks of old myths that have portrayed the gods as cruel and vindictive, such as the two we mentioned last week, the poor victims of the gods, Prometheus and Tantalus, eternally punished. Bless you. The God of Moses ordered the extermination of the Canaanites, kill them all. When he commanded Saul to kill all the Amalekites, and Saul spared the king and some livestock, God rejected him altogether. The God of Mary and Joseph blinked at the slaughter of the innocents, price that has to be paid. Is Yahweh any better than Zeus or Thor or Ra, the sun god? Lou remembers a passage from Revelation that says that the smoke of hell goes up forever in the sight of the blessed spirits and the Lamb, and the blessed spirits are unmoved. Fear starts to whisper in Lou's ear. This garden of lions and steel flowers is no place for you. But now he catches sight of a female ghost crouching behind some shrubbery. On the bus, she was dressed to the nines in the latest, most expensive fashion Melania would approve. But she's desperate to hide in the bushes from the bright spirit that is pursuing her. She has discovered that she is transparent here, that her clothes do not conceal who and what she truly is. Up close, her floating scarves and Prada satin crepe dress might as well be cobwebs. She's totally exposed here, naked in spirit, and she cannot endure the embarrassment. Her assigned spirit pleads with her to come out from the bushes and not give her appearance another thought. Why? Because everybody looks bad here when they first arrive. But her vanity and shame paralyze her. I can't go out in public like this, she cries. Everyone will see me. They will stare right through me. Yes, they will. Then, between a sob and a snarl, she asks her spirit, what are we born for? A surprising question in that context. For infinite happiness, he answers, here, frog. That's sweet. He's listening, I hope. And gently coaxes this poor woman to trust him. But she must indeed bear herself before God and drink her cup of shame. And then she will be done with it forever. For a moment, she considers it. And Lou seems especially caught up in her struggle. Instead of his usual detachment, he wants to fall at her feet and beg her, agree to the terms. But no, the poor spirit cannot bear to be seen for what she is. Exasperated, the spirit gets to the heart of it. Friend, could you, only for a moment, fix yourself on something not yourself? She cannot. Finally, last strategy. The spirit tries a kind of heavenly shock treatment to distract her from her obsession with herself. He summons, of all things, a thundering herd of unicorns, which struck me as very odd at first. But these are massive white war horses. In their discipline and power, they look as if trained for some great battle to come. The ground shakes under their hooves. Does it work? We'll never know. The shock treatment scares the hell out of Lou, and he gets out of there as fast as he can. Chapter 9, Turning. Chapter 9 is long and complex. We can only skim the surface here. But it is the turning point of the book. At last, Lou meets up with his bright spirit, who is none other than George MacDonald. And I found another book this week, which gives you the best passages from this book and other things he wrote in C.S. Lewis on George MacDonald. It's an amazing book. He was a 19th century writer, poet, and minister, and like Tolkien, he had a great part in shaping Lewis's faith. Lewis read Phantastes, which is beautifully illustrated, when he was 16, and he said it baptized his imagination, though the rest of him would take 16 more years. MacDonald used fantasy as a medium for exploring the human condition. He rejected the atonement doctrine of John Calvin, the idea that Christ was punished in our place to appease heaven's wrath. MacDonald said no. Christ came to save people from their sins, not from a divine penalty for their sins. There is evil in the universe, he says, but if you know your Genesis, you know that it predates us. The snake in the garden, as portrayed by John Milton in Paradise Lost, and if you've never read it, it's a great long epic poem, but it's magnificent. The snake is subtle and poisonous. He was once Lucifer, angel of light, closest to God in heaven. But pride and envy of God's power were his sins. And when he rebels and tries to seize the throne, he falls into the abyss that his fall creates and takes a third of heaven with him. MacDonald writes, "Christ let all the waves and billows of evil sea break over him and die without rebound. Evil, not God, spent its rage upon him, then fell back, defeated." MacDonald would say that God does not punish except to improve us. He seeks to salvage and not condemn, to find a way. Nevertheless, we should still fear God, for he will break the false selves we have made until the real selves that he made reappear. Here comes a five-star sentence. He says, on Judgment Day, everything that can be shaken will be shaken, and only the unshakable will remain. Is this the same thing as universalism? Everybody saved in the end, sooner or later? No, MacDonald's God insists that each soul participate in working out his or her own salvation. We must freely choose a moral and spiritual growth or decline and decay. Leaps of faith are required, finding a way where there is no way. If you don't take some risks, if you don't even get on the bus, similar to the Polar Express, how can you ever get anywhere? God can't and won't do it all. Chapter 9 opens with a question. Where are ye going? Lou sees Lewis's old mentor sitting on a rock. The conversation that follows and the parade of ghosts that pass them by could make a full day's discussion in itself. They talk about the doctrine of the refrigerium, that God gives the damned souls holidays. But George says most ghosts waste their holidays by going back to Earth to haunt their relatives, or to spy on their kids, or to see if their books are still selling. Lou and MacDonald talk about lust, mistaking means for ends, art, greed, power, the idea of purgatory, which Lewis believed in, and Satan's most famous line in Paradise Lost, better to reign in hell than serve in heaven. Satan will not participate in his own redemption. With MacDonald, Lou relaxes a little. He asks why the angels don't come down to hell and talk to the damned, encourage them, counsel them, instruct them, entice them to take the next bus. MacDonald's answer is profound. He says Lou can scarcely conceive how far these bright spirits have traveled from heaven's center to meet these poor ragged souls at the bus stop. Remember the parable of the rich man and the beggar. There is an uncrossable chasm between heaven and earth. Except for the bus, you literally can't get there from here. A ghost can briefly visit heaven, but a bright spirit cannot visit hell. Either or. But Lou persists, why not? Surely within God's power. Well, like gravity and time, space is different in hell. If one of Ike's golden apples couldn't fit into hell, how could an angel? Heaven is a cosmos, a vast spiritual multiverse. Hell is a spiritual black hole, a galaxy of collapsed potential shrunken to a dot. Later in chapter 13, MacDonald will explain to Lou a little bit more about space in hell. And it is quite a conception. It is that one image that has stuck with me for 50 years since I first read this. Our little bus couldn't fit in it, is all we need to know right now, nor the apple, nor the book. So together, the two-man observer ghost who is a chronic complainer, a grotesque female ghost who tries to flirt with the bright spirits, moving in ways she thinks are sexually alluring, but are actually revolting. He meets a real estate developer ghost. Let's build a railroad up here. Dam up these rivers, cut down these trees, pave over this ridiculous spiky grass. We might add, build a casino. The ghost can have fun, betting on who stays and who goes. They speak to a ghost who is a famous painter, who's very much looking forward to painting heaven, to be the first to capture the light here. Until he hears that his paintings on Earth are already out of fashion, that he's virtually forgotten. He is horrified. He has to turn this around. Next holiday, he's going to Earth, and he heads back to the bus. Questions? Any comments yet? All right, chapters 10 and 11, putting them together in the interest of time. If there were titles, it would be The Self-Sacrificing Mother and The Smothering Mother. In briefest summary, both of these chapters deal with the ghosts of women who have corrupted love. The first takes pride in how unselfishly she has sacrificed everything she ever wanted to be and do to make something of her husband, meaning richer and higher on the social ladder. He originally wanted to be a writer. A little desk in a small room or a quiet room would do for him. But there was no money or status in that. She wanted the right house in the right neighborhood to cultivate the right friends, to be upwardly mobile. But despite all her energetic efforts, he failed to give her this, unforgivably. In fact, she drove the poor man to a nervous breakdown, and she can't forgive him for that either. And yet, though he has not come to meet her today, and she cannot forgive him for his lack of ambition even now, she is willing to take up her burden again and keep making something of him in heaven or hell. She insists on it. Give him to me. So, is this just a pre-women's liberation thing? Does she truly believe that this is what a wife is supposed to do? Or is she a mercenary at heart, class conscious, covetous, a spendthrift, and a bully? She would take her poor husband back to hell with her if only they would hand him over. The second woman has turned maternal love into idolatry. She made motherhood her career and then her religion. On Earth, her love for her son Michael was so controlling and possessive, so fixated, so damaging to him, that God called Michael to heaven prematurely. But after his death, she blamed and hated God for this brutal theft and began to worship Michael's memory. His room became her shrine. It was she who owned him. She created him out of her own body, not God. A mother's love is holy, the purest in the world. How dare God take him from her? If she could take him back with her to hell, she would. To his credit, Lou pities this woman. Maternal love is all she has. Who knows where her husband and the father is? MacDonald understands this pity, but warns him to be wary of it. Until she loves God more than Michael, the creator more than the creature, she is trapped in confusion. Even the love of a bereaved mother can lapse into sin. But now comes the most famous ghost in this chapter, perhaps in the whole book. MacDonald and Lou come across a ghost with a dark, oily complexion who carries a red lizard around on his shoulder, its long tail wrapped around his arm, and it constricts at will. In this case, the ghost's sin is clearly visible. It is lust, or in our day and age, just as well, addiction. And it's constantly whispering in his ear, even when the ghost tells it to shut up. An angel, blinding bright, meets this ghost and wastes no time. He asks the ghost for permission to kill the lizard, for he cannot enter heaven wearing it. The ghost is not surprised to hear this. He knows he has a problem. But he procrastinates. He's afraid. He's sure there will be agony when this lizard is destroyed. Maybe the lizard's death will be his death also. They are so close. May I kill it? The angel persists. Half willing, the ghost says he doesn't feel well enough today to deal with it. And anyhow, the lizard is being very quiet right now. Maybe tomorrow. But the angel is adamant, may I kill it? There are no tomorrows here. All days, all time is now. It is literally now or never, either or. I will not comment on how this turns out, but if you were beginning to think that not a single ghost would choose to stay in heaven, this one does. His transformation is almost instant and total, and all the rivers and fields and mountains of heaven rejoice, and you won't believe what happens to the lizard. Okay, chapters 12 and 13. Kind of the culminating chapters in a way. A title might be one of the nameless great ones. Chapter 13 starts as a bright spirit who was one of the greatest human beings who ever lived on earth, Sarah Smith, whom no one has ever heard of, comes into view. A procession of children, musicians, dancers, animals, angels, and birds precede her when she comes on the scene. She reminds me a little of Galadriel in Lord of the Rings, if you know that trilogy. Totally at home in the world she is in. MacDonald tells Lou that there is enough joy in her little finger to waken all the dead things of the universe into life. She was a nobody on Earth. But not here. She has come to meet our last ghost, the ghost of her husband. She seeks him out, and Lou is taken aback when he sees his tall, emaciated figure, thin and shaky. He seems to be leading a little dwarf on a chain. Sarah's husband, Frank, looks and speaks like a great tragic ham actor of the old school, a lot of sighing and melodrama. But then Lou realizes that her husband is really the little dwarf. It is he who holds the tragic actor by the chain. Sarah tries so hard to break through her husband's self-pity. It's a tired old act. He can't believe that she's happy up here without him. In essence, he says, if you truly loved me, you would come back to hell with me. On earth, Sarah cared for every needy child she met as if it were her own. She treated all living things with kindness and sympathy. By contrast, Frank is still dwelling on that time he let her use his last postage stamp to write a letter to her mother when she knew he wanted it too. But she admits that she was also timid and too passive on Earth. She apologizes to Frank for being too dependent on him. But Frank liked her dependency. "Have you missed me?" the tragic actor says in a tone of profound dejection. But Sarah has grown strong in heaven. She bends down to kiss the little dwarf and tells him that he need not worry about that here. No one pines after someone or something that isn't here. There is only joy in what is here. She offers him that joy if he will just cut the chain that binds him to a false self. Frank tries to weigh it in his shrunken heart and mind. Lou says he never saw anything more terrible than the struggle of that dwarf ghost against joy. On her knees, Sarah entreats him to throw off his alter ego and be the whole true man he is. For a moment, he seems to listen and speaks once in his true voice. But then before her eyes, the effort collapses. He shrinks to the size of an insect and then disappears altogether. And the tragic actor, the ghost of a ghost, swallows the chain. Sarah lets him go without tears. Though she loved him, still does, his self-annihilation does not compromise her joy. There is no help for it. She must let him go. The Eskimos have a word for that. In the worst, hardest, severest winters, they would have to lose a good number of their elders in particular because there wasn't enough food to go around. And the word Ionamut summarizes this idea. There is no help for it. We must let them go to save the children. "You do not love me," the actor intones to Sarah, meaning, "Stop loving everybody else. Love me. Stop being happy without me. Pity me. Ask me what hell is like without you. Focus on me. Love me." Her answer is beautiful. Another five-star line. "I am in love himself," meaning Christ, "and out of it I will not go." But Lou is left troubled by this last meeting between a saved and a damned soul. Sarah seems untouched by her husband's fate. That bothers him. And shouldn't she be grieving for his misery, at least for a little while, if not forever, even if it is self-made? MacDonald's final answer to this is no nonsense. It is stern and unyielding and convincing to me against my will. "This is the heart of the matter," he says. "Pity for the finally damned is futile and wasted. Shall they, with cunning tears, hold the saints in heaven hostage to their misery forever?" But there is, of course, another barrier to Sarah's joining Frank in hell out of pity. It's not just the fixed chasm. Her spiritual body could not fit into hell any more than Ikey's apple could. Lou protests at this. He has seen hell. It's mammoth. It contains multitudes, trillions of square miles, and ever expanding. He describes to MacDonald the infinite chasm that the bus ascended and points in the direction of the high cliff where the bus sat down on the grass. And here we come to that image that stuck with me for 50 years. Just going to read it directly. In this issue, or in this edition, it's on page 122. My teacher gave a curious smile. Look, he said. And with the word, he went down on his hands and knees. I did the same. How it hurt my knees. And presently saw that he had plucked a blade of grass. Using its thin end as a pointer, he made me see, after I had looked very closely, a crack in the soil, so small that I could not have identified it without his aid. I cannot be certain, he said, that this is the crack that you came up through, but through a crack no bigger than this did you come up. For some reason, I remembered it as the bus coming up through a crack in my kitchen floor, but it would be so tiny. It expands into the size that Lou has always thought it was, only as it enters heaven. All of hell, he goes on to say, is smaller than a piece of pea gravel on earth, smaller than a single atom of heaven's substance. Real and substantial Sarah could not compress herself enough to enter that black hole. For a damned soul is nearly nothing and takes up very little space. But George says one spirit, Christ, could make himself small enough to enter hell and reach the prisoners, and there was no soul in heaven to whom he did not speak. One last thing. George mentions to Lou a Lady Julian of Norwich, a Christian mystic who lived in the 14th century. She had a vision of Christ, and in her vision, she asked him one question. Why did God not prevent sin? For then all would be well. She heard Christ answer, all will be well, and all will be well, and all manner of things will be well. Abandon all questions for now, George says, for all answers deceive. That's a great line, too, just three words. Chapter 14, Terror. The first line of this short last chapter, and suddenly all was changed, is reminiscent of 1 Corinthians 15, verse 52. Paul writes, in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, the trumpet shall sound, and we shall all be changed. Suddenly, Lou sees in heaven a vision of countless, motionless, bright forms looking down on a silver chessboard with figures moving to and fro. Seeing it, he feels dizzy, anguished. He asks MacDonald if all these experiences in heaven are real, or is it a dream? And the honest answer is, yes. It is a dream, a vision. You are not really in heaven. The bitter drink of your death is yet to come. But then, with his back to heaven's mountains, Lou notices that MacDonald's face and figure are taking on a golden sheen, as if the whole landscape is flushed with a brighter light. And then he hears 10,000 voices of birds and angels and hounds and horns and trees shout, sleepers awake. This is it. The sun is rising on judgment day. But instead of joy, Lou feels nothing but terror. He grabs hold of MacDonald's robe. as he sees the burning rim of the sun shoot time dead with golden arrows. He screams, "The morning, the morning. I am caught in the morning and I am a ghost." But then, like Scrooge on Christmas morning, that may have occurred to you too, he wakes up and finds that he's clutching the cloth of his writing table. So, could this be construed as an escape, like Scrooge, to a happy ending? I'm okay. I'm alive. I'm not a ghost. I'm home. I'm home. In the last three lines, Lou becomes Lewis. He looks at his clock. It's 3 a.m., the soul's midnight. His room is cold. The fire grate is black and empty. It is black outside his windows, and the angel voices have changed into the howling of air raid sirens. It is the hell of London in 1944. And that's the end. Thank you. Do you hear that frog? It can't be just me. See outside? Okay. It's such a sad ending in a way, such a sober ending. And we know of only one, possibly two ghosts that actually chose heaven over hell, even knowing what both places were like. One last note. 1944 was the year that the Nazis deployed their two revenge weapons, the V1 buzz bombs that looked like today's drones, and the V2 rocket, which my father could remember, the first long-range ballistic missile. It could travel at over 3,500 miles per hour at top speed, which is faster than the speed of sound. You couldn't hear it coming. 500 of them hit London in 1944, killing thousands. It was meant to terrorize, to break the British will to keep on fighting. Fortunately, Germany was losing the war in 1944, and this attempt at psychological warfare failed. But even so, Hitler was still setting as many fires as he could, taking as many lives. All right, questions or comments? Let me start with a couple of questions to think about. In the beginning, we said Lewis called this book a fantasy with a moral. What is the moral? What do you think the moral of the book is? If you can narrow it down to just one. Question number two. All answers deceive, so don't worry. It doesn't matter what you say. Do you have a favorite line or image that will stick with you? For me, it's that bus, teeny tiny little bus coming out of a crack. Is there anything that struck you as particularly memorable, powerful?
I'll say, you didn't at all address the last chapter where he says, "I saw a great assembly of gigantic forms all motionless in front of forever a little silver table and looking upon it."
Yeah. Are you asking?
So I got to that point and I thought, what is this? And they all had platonic.
Yes, they are platonic.
Ideals.
Ideals. That's a good idea.
So I have my best self, really, in heaven, looking down at what my little self is doing on this silver table, which somewhere he calls time.
Yeah. and all of us moving to and fro, and some getting somewhere, others staying on that plane or further below.
So I found myself thinking about this during the week as I did something just ordinary but questionable. You know, would my best self have been doing that?
We all do.
What does my better angel think of that? I found myself thinking this because of this image. Comment.
Good.
That's what I remember.
Nice. Anyone else? Any image that struck you as particularly impressive or insightful on Lewis's part? I'm just going to take a survey right now. How many of you liked this book? Okay, just about everybody. Would those who do not like this book like to say anything? Yes.
I didn't like it in the beginning because you had more work to do to get into heaven after you died. And that's not Reformed theology. And then I had to realize, well, he's probably Church of England. And right. He does believe in purgatory, which I think is a big cheat. And I don't know. But I did give him credit for centering so many of the early ghosts' faults in that they were so self-absorbed.
Yeah.
That's where their whole sin came from. Mm-hmm. They couldn't accept the possibility of heaven because it had nothing to do with them. Mm-hmm. They couldn't see it.
Selfishness seems to be at the heart of much of it. A selfishness that becomes so habitual, they aren't aware of it and they have no idea what to do about it. Don't want to do anything about it. The two women, I mean, they're serious, of course, but they kind of had a little bit of comical nature about them because he's presenting here stereotypes as well. But when you are writing an allegory or a fantasy, you can get away with that. And we just kind of have a willing suspension of disbelief. Okay, for now, we're in hell. For now, we're in heaven. But yes, he takes great theological liberties. And in fact, I don't know if it's this edition or another one where he writes a disclaimer and says, basically, please do not feel that I'm asking you to take any of this literally. This is a dream narrative. It's fantasties type stuff. But we can learn maybe a few things along the way. It's kind of a long, long parable in a way. Anything else? Let me read one more thing to you, which might provoke a question. While I'm reading this, think about what is Lou's sin? Why was he damned? In all that you read, did you detect a problem with Lou that would be enough to damn him to hell? Hold that question. Remember the hard-bitten man who said that a powerful combine controls everything, that there are two sets of laws, one for the 1% and the rest for the 99%. He would not be surprised to learn that while you and I might be thrown in jail for shoplifting, a Nazi war criminal like Werner von Braun, who joined the SS and designed the V-2 rocket missile that killed thousands, got off scot-free. Over 10,000 slave laborers died just building the V-2s. He saw their suffering, walked past the corpses at the end of every workday, but made no objection. After the war, von Braun escaped trial for his war crimes. He was smuggled into the U.S., and we hired him to make missiles for us and to get us to the moon before the Soviets. He was celebrated as a hero of the space age. Gerald Ford awarded him the National Medal of Science and Engineering in 1975. The hard-bitten man would say, "Of course, that's the way the world works." All right, what is Lu Xin? Any nominations? I have an idea, but I'm not sure. There's one passage in which the angel, or George MacDonald, is questioning him, and Lu suddenly changes the subject. He diverts the conversation in another direction. Do any of you remember that? It's very easy to miss. No? Anybody? All right, let me read it to you, and this might give us a little bit of insight. I think it's around, 72. The narrator, or the bright spirit George, for him, is talking about people who do research and who are not, who don't really care so much what they find, but they're just, you know, going over reams and reams of material, and then to share it with others becomes their passion, rather than the truth or falsehood of what they are actually saying, maybe. He's talking about a researcher, he says, who cared nothing about joy. In the end, all he really wanted was to keep doing research. "How fantastic," says Lu. "Do you think so?" said the teacher with a piercing glance. "It is nearer to such as you than you think. There have been men before now who got so interested in proving the existence of God that they came to care nothing for God himself. As if the good Lord had nothing to do but exist. There have been some who were so occupied in spreading Christianity that they never gave a thought to Christ." Then, moved by a desire to change the subject, I asked why, and then he goes on to talk about something else. I think over time, as an intellectual, Lu worried that he was spending so much time trying to convince people of the Godhead of Jesus Christ rather than being Christ for other people who needed it. I know that worried him. So maybe that's it. Anything, maybe intellectual pride. One other quote, and let me see what I put on the back there. How many of you had to read Paradise Lost in high school? Really? Two, at least. That's more than I expected. Nobody reads it anymore, and it's a shame. It was that poem and music in the church I grew up in, that did a great deal for my own faith. Yeah. Two quotes here that I will leave you with. And this one is from Paradise Lost, spoken by Lucifer, who becomes Satan. He says, "The mind is its own place, and in itself can make a heaven of hell or a hell of heaven. We don't need to go anywhere to be in either one, in a sense." And then this, I love this. Lewis and Tolkien were very, very close, as we have said. After Lewis's death, Tolkien said, "So far, I have felt the normal feelings of a man my age, like an old tree that is losing all its leaves one by one. But this," Lewis's death, "feels like an axe blow near the roots." You probably have all lost someone and had that kind of feeling. All right, folks, if there are no more questions or anything, yes. Ah. Oh.
Just to repeat the question, what do you suggest that we need read next?
One thing, maybe that we could talk about sometime, is a play that is almost forgotten by Archibald MacLeish called J.B. And it's a modern play based on the Book of Job about how a man who is splendidly successful in our own time slowly but surely loses his wealth, loses his house, loses his properties, loses his money, loses his children, everything gone from him. Something like maybe what one poor, or more than one, several people in Gaza feel right now when they've lost all their children, their home, just everything. And will J.B. crack? Will he lose his faith? Because he does believe in God. His wife becomes the hard-bitten man. She becomes very cynical and angry at him. Curse God and die. But he holds on. And it's a good thing maybe to read J.B. and Job at the same time and just see how the two writers deal with it. Job is almost like a tragic play. And you may have read before that the happy ending was tacked on later in the original story. All that loss remains loss. And you know probably where it ends, and that is with utter submission to God. But why and how psychologically is that possible? So that's one possibility. Anybody have a book request that they would like to throw out to the rest of us? Anything good you're reading? Yes. He's coming.
Tolkien does have a story called Leif by Nigel, which has a lot of these same images in it of the mountains.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that interesting?
Main characters.
Yeah. They both, they shared a lot in imagery, particularly of nature. They were very close to mountains, seas, rivers, trees, and were so sad to see what the 20th century was doing to it. And he would be sadder now, I'm sure. But yes, that's certainly a possibility. What is the title? I have not read it. What is the title of it?
It's a novella called Leif by Nigel. A man who starts, he's an artist, and he starts painting a magnificent tree, and what is left at the end is a leaf.
Okay, very good. Thank you. I'll find that. There's something I should have brought a couple copies with me if I can find them. There is a beautiful little essay. I mean, it will take you 6 minutes, maybe not even that, 4 minutes to read, called How to Unchop a Tree. And it's about what you must do to put back together one tree with all of the cells and the, you know, whatever you call them, arteries that a tree has, all the cobwebs, all the stored nuts, all the insects, all the birds' nests, all the broken branches when they fall on the ground, the difficulty of putting even that together. And then it ends with a very chilling line. You have failed, probably, you know. Everything will have to be put back. Everything that we've destroyed, ruined, without thought, will someday have to be put back one way or another. I'll see if I can find that. It's really beautifully written. Anything else, folks? If you have the courage and the time, maybe just get a cheap paperback of Paradise Lost. It'll be the best money you ever spent. And dive in. It's poetry, but it's not difficult. I read it when I was a teenager and then read it maybe three or four more times. It's thick. I mean, it's an epic poem like Homer's Odyssey. But it filled in so many gaps in my understanding of Christian theology. It's beautiful. It's memorable. And people are still quoting it, but they don't know where it came from. Better to reign in hell than serve in heaven. That line you hear a lot. Okay, are we done?
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.